Either way, that's when I walked in, and there Garrison was, like, bent over, spreading his cheeks.
Okay. Okay. This fucking guy.
Oh, that was perfect. Oh, that was great.
Oh, shit, sorry, I didn't realize we were recording. Yeah, he was, I don't know what he was trying to do, actually.
Was there a strange look on his face?
Oh, no, he looked like he was enjoying it.
Yeah, why don't you mind your own fucking business, eh?
Hey, I mean, you sent the invite.
Yeah, right?
I wanted to roleplay that it was a surprise. What do you mean, fantasy modeler?
Oh, God, and on that disturbing note, welcome to the Micro Machines podcast. This week, we will be talking about the CAC Boomerang, the little Aussie indigenous fighter. However, before we do that, we've got to start with some introductions. So you have me, Callum, from New Zealand, currently having a nice cold zero sugar Coke.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's not the best.
Well, you got me, Garrison, out here in Kansas. I've got a fresh coffee, my vape, and a little beautiful stug that I'm about to weather.
Nice. And you got me, Clint, in Indiana, and I have me a nice Arnold Palmer.
Good lad.
Yes.
Nice. All right, so this week we're going to be talking about the CAC Boomerang, the only fighter that Australia actually designed and built. We're going to go through all the history about it. There are still a few flying examples, which unfortunately I missed at an air show once, but oh well. They're really cool, and they have a few things in common with, say, you know, the Buffalo and stuff like that, but let's get into it. The development. In the mid-1930s, political leaders noted that both Japan and Nazi Germany seemed to be preparing for war, prompting many countries, including Australia, to begin their own preparations, although not fast enough. Australia's small aircraft industry needed major expansion to produce modern combat aircraft. Tungyan Aircraft, while having built a few twin-engine transports, lacked the capacity to produce large numbers of military aircraft. The country had limited experience in aircraft manufacturing, relying on imports, mostly from the UK. In response, the Australian government encouraged three companies to form the Commonwealth Aircraft Corporation, or CAC, in October 1936, aimed at developing a self-sufficient aircraft industry. Tungyan Aircraft was later absorbed into CAC. CAC established manufacturing and testing facilities in Melbourne, sourcing equipment from Britain and the US, initially focused on producing the CAC Wirraway, a licensed version of the North American NA-16, the company eventually received large orders for military aircraft, especially fighters for the Royal Australian Air Force, or the RAAF, or, if you're Australian, RAF. That's how they say it. It's RAF. In July 1940, with Britain fighting alone against Germany, Australia acknowledged it could no longer rely on British aircraft supplies. Well, it's because it is a fucking long way.
Right?
Wait, literally on the other side of the world.
Oh, it's not that bad.
The Pacific War began on December 7th, 1941, with Japan attacking multiple locations.
Which is today.
Oh, yeah, it is.
It is today.
Do we say Happy Pearl Harbor? No. Yeah, I don't know what you say. Actually, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't say Happy Pearl Harbor Day.
Yeah, no. Commiserations on Pearl Harbor Day? Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
I don't know either. It's got kind of awkward.
Yeah, suddenly turned awkward. Anyway, within months, Japan controlled vast areas of the Pacific, putting Australia in a vulnerable position. At the time, Australian squadrons were stationed in Europe and Malaya, but they lacked adequate fighters. The RAAF's aircraft, mostly from the UK, were limited due to Britain's own wartime needs. Meanwhile, the US aircraft industry was forced was focused on its own military and shipping delays caused by German and Japanese submarines, made sourcing aircraft overseas even more difficult. The RAAF was in urgent need of a stronger fighter force. And these are some of the fighters that, well, you know, quote, fighters they had. Of course, you have the Wirraway in the top right. Looks a bit like a Harvard or Texan.
Mm-hmm.
Although, however, it was believed that the Wirraway was developed from the Texan or something like that. In fact, it wasn't. Both the Wirraway and the Texan come from the NA-16. So they were. So it's not like one developed from the other. It's more of a family tree of branching off into different ways. So,
okay.
And then, of course, the RAAF had few Buffaloes and Hudsons at the time. So the origins of the Buffalo, of the fucking Buffalo, Boomerang. Jesus Christ.
You got this.
I mean, it looks like a Buffalo to me.
Somehow it looks like a slightly longer Buffalo.
Yeah.
I don't think that is a Buffalo as well, by the way. No, it's not. That is not a Buffalo.
Okay.
In late 1941, Lawrence Wackett, that you could not have that last name nowadays.
Oh,
hey, Mr. Wackett.
Bro got bullish in high school.
And rightfully so, right?
Yes.
Well, especially back in those days, like kids, you'd call a young boy Master So and So. You imagine that, Master Wackett?
Oh.
Oh dear. Anyway, poor old Wackett, chief designer at CAC, explored designing a new Australian-made fighter aircraft. At the time, Australia had no experience in manufacturing fighter planes, and many experts doubted the country's capability to do so. Wackett decided to base the design on existing aircraft produced locally, primarily the CAC Wirraway, derived from the North American NA-16, and the Bristol Beaufort Bomber. The NA-16 had been adapted into the North American NA-50 fighter used by Peru, and the CAC's Wirraway license allowed for modifications. This choice minimized tooling requirements and sped up the design process. While the Beaufort was successful as a twin-engine attack aircraft, it was unsuitable for a single-engined interceptor. However, the 1,200-horsepower Pratt & Whitney R-1830 engines used in the Beaufort were also powering the U.S. Navy's F-4F Wildcat, making them a logical choice for the new fighter. Hmm. Wackett quickly enlisted designer Fred David, an Austrian refugee and former intern who had worked for Heinkel, Mitsubishi, and Iachi, giving him expertise in advanced fighter designs like the Japanese Zero and the Heinkel HE-112.
Bam.
Bro's got a fucking resume.
He'll be sitting there like, oh, they brought out the new one. I designed that.
I can't remember working on this.
In December 1941, CAC approved the design for a new fighter, the CA-12, combining the Wirraway wing, tail, and undercarriage with a new fuselage to accommodate the larger twin Wasp engine. It featured a single-seat cockpit, a sliding hood, and an armament of two 20mm cannons and four 303 machine guns. I gotta say, for a small little fighter, this thing was heavily armed. Like, that's more than what a Zero's got.
Oh,
small but mighty. Good to go.
Yeah. I mean, this is the garrison of the fighter corps. The Australian government approved the project as a safeguard against delays in P-40 orders and to sustain CAC's production. On 18th of February 1942, the War Cabinet ordered 105 CA-12 aircraft, which were effectively commissioned off the drawing board before any prototypes or flights had occurred. The aircraft was named Boomerang. So you can see up here, you have the 303 Brownings and the, how do you pronounce it? Hispano Suiza? You know, the British ones that don't have a British name.
Right.
Hispano Suiza. Yeah, that's them. Oh, and also down here, this is the NA-50 fighter. Unfortunately, I couldn't find one in Peruvian scheme, which would have been pretty cool.
Yeah.
Oh well. So, prototypes and early productions. On the 29th of May 1942, the Boomerang prototype, a 46-1, as you can see in the top right, made its maiden flight from Fisherman's Bend, piloted by Ken Freewin. Yeah, Freewin.
Freewin.
Yep. Completed in just 3 months, a rare feat at the time, A46-1 underwent a series of successful test flights with both Freewin and RAAF pilot John Harper. Minor engine cooling issues led to design changes, including an oil cooler intake revision and a propeller spinner on later models. Flight tests comparing the Boomerang with the Brewster Buffalo, P-40E Kitty Hawk, and P-400 Aero Cobra, which, in case you're confused, the P-400 and the P-39 are both the same. It's just the P-400 was the export-only version, and it didn't have the 37 millimeter in the nose. It only had a 20 mil.
Yep.
So, just for people out there. Anyway, showed that the Boomerang was faster than the Buffalo in level flight, but less maneuverable. It outgunned all rivals with two 20mm cannons and 4.303 caliber machine guns, and its pilots had better protection due to its armor. However, its performance dropped above 15,000 feet with a top speed of 265 knots or 490 kilometers an hour, making it less effective against faster Japanese fighters like the Zero and Ki-43, as well as any European planes. I must say, you can see the differences between the Boomerang and the P-400. The P-400 just looks so sleek compared to stubbiness.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's a mid-engine, so it's more like a McLaren.
Yeah. And a hot take, the P-39 or 400 in British and Commonwealth colours look better than in American colours. Just got to say that. Put it out there.
Oh, I agree. But we didn't want it anyway.
You guys didn't want it, and everyone else found it success with it. So clearly, you guys just had a skill issue with it.
Oh, it was, very useful with the Cactus Air Force. It's like we had a whole bunch of P-400s that was meant for England, but it's like the Marines needed planes on the ground, so we started diverting them to Guadalcanal.
And I mean, the Allison engine, because that's what they had, wasn't it? It was the Allison.
Not sure. We should do an episode on them.
Yeah, but I do know, for stuff like low level fights, which is what most of the Pacific was, the lower level stuff, the Allison actually outperformed a lot of engines, especially the Merlin. The Merlin was better at high altitude. The Allison was actually better performing at lower altitudes, hence why stuff like the P-39 was much better as a ground attack, which is why the Soviets loved it.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Putting that aside, by March 1942, pressure to mass produce the CA-12 eased as USAAF units with P-40 and P-39 fighters were deployed to northern Australia, and the RAAF began receiving Kitty Hawks. Manufacturing of the original order for 105 CA-12s was completed in June 1943. Oof, that is quite late in the war for a bad design.
Yeah.
During production, several upgrades were made, including strengthened spinner plates, underwing night flying lights, and a revised electrical starter system. Many of these changes were retrofitted to early models. Due to delays with the CAC I'll tell you one thing. Australia might give New Zealand shit for weird names for stuff, but they have no leg to stand on because they have names like Woomera. You guys have a guess.
Whatever the fuck that is.
Woomera?
Woomera.
Whatever. The Woomera bomber project. The Australian government extended Boomerang production from 105 to 250 aircraft. The new order included the CA-13, 14, 14A, and 19 variants, with 95 13s, 49 19s completed. Only one prototype of the supercharged CA-14 and CA-14A was built. The final Boomerang, a CA-19, was completed in February 1945. They had some further developments. During flight testing of the initial CA-12 model, CAC began developing a new variant, the CA-14, with improved speed, climb, and ceiling. designed around an order for 145 US-built Wright Cyclone R2600 engines with 1,700 horsepower. Delays in delivery led Wackett to authorize the use of the more powerful 1,850 horsepower Pratt & Whitney R2800, available from CAC factories in mid-1942. Due to the Boomerang's compact fuselage, the engine's supercharger was placed in the rear, and a new three-bladed variable pitch Curtiss propeller was initially used. The increased weight of the Pratt & Whitney R2800 engine created a risk of undercarriage failure. This engine would later influence the design in the Boomerang successor, the CAC CA-15 Kangaroo, also known as the Uncanny Valley Mustang. bottom left right here. It's, yeah, like, you know.
Bro,
yeah.
The cockpit looks so fucking weird.
It's just an out of proportion. It's someone described the Mustang, we'll say.
It looks pregnant.
Bro, that's the Mustang after the war. Just gain some weight, okay?
Right.
No. That's the Mustang you have at home.
Oh, God.
It's not to sound, you know, bad, but it looks like it's kind of like a Mustang with downs.
Yeah. It's poor guy.
Yeah.
Hey, he's special, okay?
Apparently, though, it did actually fly really well, and it was really good, but by the time they got around to building it, it was like, there was no need.
Right.
There was only a few of those built. Anyway, back to the Boomerang. In response, CAC reverted to the twin Wasp engine, adding a General Electric B2 turbo supercharger mounted in the rear fuselage. They also introduced a new propeller gear, a geared cooling fan, and inspired by intelligence on German BMW 801 engines used in the Focke-Wulf 190A, and a larger squared-off tail fin and rudder, as you can see down here. Up top, we have the 14 with the supercharger on the side, and then you have the 14A with the with the squared off tail. So it looks kind of more Wildcat. It goes from Buffalo to Wildcat look, but it does look strange with that massive.
Oh, that massive supercharger on the side of it.
Like the fact that they had to actually move the fuselage roundel out of the way. Now it just looks wrong.
It does.
By July 1943, the redesigned CA-14 prototype, now the CA-14A, had a top speed 20 to 30% higher than the CA-12 and an operational ceiling 4,000 feet higher. Not bad. No. Testing of later Boomerang variants showed they performed comparably to the Spitfire Mark V and early P-47 Thunderbolt and P-51 Mustang models under certain conditions. However, by this time, the Spitfire had already taken over the interceptor role, and CAC was preparing to manufacture Mustangs under license for bomber escort, air superiority, and close air support. As a result, the CA-14 was never put into production. It's kind of impressive. It was kind of on par with some of those very impressive aircraft. You know, like, I mean, yes, under certain conditions. I mean, wish I could actually find what they meant by certain conditions. You know, like, is it like treetop flying? Is it turns? Is it, you know, what is it? What are the conditions?
Right. maybe in a steep dive.
Up in and
straight
find
to
out.
The ground. But so, for a reference for photos, up here you have the two different engines. You have the R2600 on the left and the R2800 on the right. Slight differences in the design, but both very cool looking engines. All right, operational history. On 19th October 1942, CA-12 A-46-6 became the first Boomerang to reach a training unit, joining No. 2 OTU from 1AD to train pilots. While it was generally successful, pilots without prior operational experience struggled with its poor forward visibility, prompting the relocation of the reflector gun sight for improvement. Number 83 Squadron was the first fighter unit to receive boomerangs, replacing Aero Cobras at Strathpine Airfield on 10th of April 1943. A few weeks later, Number 84 Squadron on Horn Island also received CA-12s, followed by Number 85 Squadron at RAAF Guildford, replacing their Buffaloes. On 16th May 1943, boomerangs encountered Japanese aircraft for the first time, engaging three Mitsubishi G4M bombers, but causing little damage. They must have been shit pilots then, if you've got two 20s and four 303s.
Right.
That's an embarrassment.
Yeah. On the 20th of May 1943, Flight Lieutenant Roy Goon... Oh, dear. Poor bastard. He would never survive nowadays. He became the first boomerang pilot to scramble against Japanese bombers during a patrol from RAAF Learmouth, although the bombers dropped their payloads harmlessly before leaving. Most patrols were uneventful. Number 84 Squadron was deployed to a U.S. Army Air Force's bomber base on Horn Island to counter Japanese air raids and address the fighter shortage in preparation for a small offensive in New Guinea. However, the boomerang's low speed and poor high-altitude performance limited its effectiveness in combat. The squadron was able to drive off enemy attacks, but struggled to engage Japanese aircraft effectively. After 8 months, Number 84 upgraded to the Kitty Hawk. In addition to air defense, the squadron provided cover for shipping near Papua. While the boomerang never recorded a confirmed kill, it never shot anything out of the air.
Oh, that's some bullshit.
However,
you mean as heavily armed as it was?
Yeah. However, when it came to ground targets, it did some damage.
Okay.
It proved valuable as a ground attack aircraft, replacing the Wirraway in Army Cooperation Squadrons. It contributed to the ground war in the Southwest Pacific, performing close quarters missions, strafing Japanese forces, marking targets with smoke bombs, and conducting artillery spotting, reconnaissance, supply drops, and anti-malarial spraying. The boomerang excelled in ground attack due to its range, heavy armament, agility, ease of flight, and durability. Its armor and wood aluminium frame allowed it to withstand significant battle damage. However, some were shot down, including two by U.S. forces.
If you would have just put the star on there instead of just a round ball, you know.
Hey, it's white. They took the little red dot off, so you guys wouldn't do that.
Really? Yeah. Should have put a star in the center of it.
Yeah, but then it looked ugly. So
clear, you leave Garrison's mom out of this, okay?
Yeah. Damn it! Come on.
US Air Force, and many were damaged in accidents, especially from ground looping. Apparently had a little bit of an issue with that. Number 4 and Number 5 squadrons used boomerangs in New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, and Borneo, achieving success in close support roles. Flying in pairs, they carried out bombing, strafing, infantry support, and artillery spotting. Boomerangs often worked with larger aircraft, marking targets with smoke bombs for others to attack from a distance. A collaboration between No. 5 Squadron and RNZAF Corsairs during the Bougainville campaign was particularly effective. The New Zealand pilots started calling the boomerangs Smoky Joes, because the boomerangs would go in first and start shooting things up, and because they were very good at low flying and stuff like that, they could drop smoke bombs right on targets that needed to be taken out. They'd do these runs up and down, shoot what they wanted up, drop smoke bombs, and then a whole bunch of New Zealand Corsairs would come in and then just, do Corsair things.
Yes! Corsairs!
But it was actually quite interesting reading about all that kind of stuff. That's one part of the Pacific War I'm doing a lot of reading into and research and stuff right now is New Zealand and Australia's role in the Pacific. In the Pacific War, did you know that New Zealand actually had a tank division in the Pacific? We had Mark III Valentine tanks in, I think it's the Green Islands, in the Solomons. And they had a really cool green and two-tone green camouflage with them and stuff like that. They look really cool. I've got decals for one, and I bought decals to make a Mark III Valentine in the Green Islands Solomons campaign, only to realize that I don't have a Mark III Valentine. I have a Mark IV Valentine, and they are very, very different in the turret.
Well, so you're going to have to buy one. Another Valentine, bro.
Yeah, but the only kit that actually has the Mark III Valentine is AFV Club, and that thing is like $90 to $100.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's a bit...
Yeah. Now, I do have one question, though.
Yeah?
Wouldn't you think that, sometime during development you'd realize that the gun sight was in the way of things?
I mean, there's a lot of things you look at, military wise, where you're sitting and go, why didn't they do this? And they just went, meh. I mean, there's a lot of things in the US military that's like, this is really shit. We know about it. We're still going to do it. So we're not going to change anything unless someone actually,
You ain't wrong.
What I want to know is what they mean by relocation. Like, where did it actually go? Did they do like the Germans where they put it off to the side? Oh well, I couldn't find it. It didn't elaborate on that. It just says, everything I've read is just says it was relocated. Talk about generalization,
right?
No kidding.
So, color schemes. Initial schemes consisted of earth brown and foliage green over sky blue undersides. Later schemes, they ended up being overall foliage green. And foliage green is a horrific color of green. I've got to say, it's ugh. Both schemes also included white theater recognition markings on the tails. So you can see here, both the early and later camouflage, they had these white tails fully painted. I think New Zealand also used this kind of thing to show off theater markings, but. Yeah, I built one. I did the multicolor, but if you wanted to be lazy, you could do a full all over green. And honestly, I think with the white tail, they look much better.
Oh yeah, that white tail kicks.
Agreed. Kind of slaps.
All right, we'll go through the. I think there's only four. There's only four variants, and we'll go through the kits. So if you wanted to build one, you can. So first off, we have the CA-12 Boomerang, also known as the Mark I, the first single-seat fighter version. 105 of these were built. And if you want to build these, well, you only really have two options, and this is going to be a recurring theme through this. So the first is you have either Tasman or Kiwi Wings. They're basically the same company now. And these are short-run injection molded, but that's very it's like the injection mold that feels like resin, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the I don't think I built this one, I built the CA-13 one. They are all right to build, they do offer it in 48 and 72nd scale. Not for a beginner modeler, we'll say. A lot of care and attention is needed. And if you don't want to go for that run, the Kiwi Wings or the Tasman model one, your other option is Special Hobby. They have both in 48 and 72nd scale. One thing I do like about Special Hobby is, like, even though they have the same box art, they have 48 in a blue scheme and 72nd in this sort of dark red scheme. It's kind of it's a nice way to differentiate scales.
Yeah,
that is nice.
Up next, you have the CA-13 Boomerang, which is basically an improved version of the CA-12. 95 of these were built. This is the one that this is the version that I built. You'll notice, you have this sort of spiky exhaust, whereas the CA-12 does not have a spiky exhaust. If you see what?
Yeah. Why do they make it look like a pine cone?
I guess it's a bit like, say, the Hotchkiss machine gun, and how it's got the ribbed
heat barrel. Dissipation.
Yeah, that's my own. That's the only thing that comes to mind.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And for the CEA 13, you do have Kiwi Wings or Tasman or you know, it's all under the same company now. They have that in 48 scale. You have an Airfix Vintage Classic, which came out a few years ago with their Commonwealth CA 13 Boomerang, which I've seen built, and it's not too bad, actually.
Nice.
And then, of course, you have two from Special Hobby in the 48 and 72nd scale. Up next, the CA 14 and the 14A Boomerang. The CA 14 is one aircraft fitted with a turbo supercharged engine. Did not enter production. Serial number is A46-1001. And then you have the CA 14A prototype, which was later modified to have the square tail and rudder, as you can see right here. And there are only two kits you can buy for either the CA-14 or 14A, both in 72nd scale, and both are resin kits from NKR. Don't know how good those would be, but, I mean, if I come across it and it was at a decent price, I probably would buy one, especially the 14A. I'd definitely get the 14A.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty cool looking.
It is literally like you cut it in half... You have Buffalo on the front, Wildcat on the rear.
Yeah. Then you got You're a lightning wrong. Super turbocharger on the side of it, or supercharger. Yeah.
and with the canopy of a Kitty Hawk.
Yeah, yeah.
And lastly, we have the CA-19 Boomerang, the tactical reconnaissance variant with a single vertical camera in the fuselage. 49 were built. Serial numbers were A46-201 to A46-249. And you can see here a very nicely preserved and restored CA-19 Boomerang. This one is based in Australia. I can't remember which museum has got it, but this I'd love to see flying. I've seen videos of it flying, and because it's got the Curtiss Wright in it, it sounds more impressive than it looks, we'll say. It's like it sounds like something like a fucking Corsair or something like that coming through, and you just see the stubby little plane going past.
So can I be that guy?
Go for it.
It's like they over-weathered it. Look at all that paint chipping.
Incorrect.
That doesn't happen on real aircraft.
Is that paint chipping, or is that just like a bad reflection?
I mean, if you look at the ring here...
Yeah, I think it's chipping, bro.
Yeah.
If you look at the wing, it's like you could see the primer showing through.
Oh, yeah, look at that. That's nice. Nice little detail. And if you want to build a CA-19 Boomerang, well, you have two again, Kiwi Wings and Tasman models in 48 and 72nd, as well as Special Hobby in 48 and 72nd. Their one is the Jungle Scouts. CA-19, and as you can see in the box art here, and a homage to their work with Corsairs, because you have the New Zealand Corsairs in the background and the RAAF Boomerang in the front leading the attack. Very nice little touch to it. They clearly did their research on that box art. And that is it. That is all for the CAC Boomerang, a bit of a short one this week, but it was a very short aircraft, so what can you expect? But it was a bad joke, all right? I needed something.
It's all right.
It wasn't
I laughed.
Bad. It was actually pretty. It was a good dad joke.
All right, so we are going to go on to a brief intermission. Then we're going to carry on with the episode, talking about the modeling news, what's been going on, our own works in progress, recommendations, and all of that kind of good stuff. So we'll be right back. And we are back with the hobby news, and let's see what is going on. So first up, from AZ Model Plastic Kits, they are bringing out a Beech SD-117S Stagger Wing with float planes. although I would much prefer ones with the folding landing gear. We have a couple of these in Auckland that are super cool. They're really sleek, really nice looking aircraft. So definitely something I wouldn't mind having.
That is a pretty slick looking aircraft.
Oh, they're definitely the sort of 30s design, sort of sleek biplane. They're so nice. I'd really want one.
It's all right.
From Meng, they're bringing out a Boeing EA-18G Growler. It makes me laugh every time. The Americans couldn't have named something worse.
Oh, yeah, it's you guys ride around in fucking snatches. It's a personnel carrier.
So, of course, the Growler band, this variant is the electronic attack aircraft, the Yellow Jackets. So most of the differences with their latest kits is primarily decals and converting it into a Growler. So wouldn't mind having one myself, because Ming and 48 scale is usually pretty good.
So shit on the name, but you want to have it.
What? And a what?
Shit on the name, but you want to have it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just funny. It's called a Growler. Just, yeah. Being from the Commonwealth and having a British heritage, I know it's just funny what slang that word is.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough.
You know, like, you guys know what it means, eh?
Oh, yeah, I know what it means.
No, I don't.
Again, it's like they have... just like they have the snatch personnel carrier.
Growler and snatch are the same thing.
Yep.
Proceed.
Enough said.
Enough said.
You will never look at an EA-18 again the same way, will you now?
Proceed.
I mean, it always gives me a chuckle, too. So.
Oh, yeah. It's always good. So we've got, you know, whenever it's like, oh, the Growlers are flying. All right.
Really?
It's like, oh, look, there's a Growler over at that airbase. I am interested.
All I see is aircraft. What the hell?
So, hey, you lied. Okay, up next from Armory in 72nd scale, they're bringing out two Kraz 250. I don't know what these are. Kraz? CRAZ? Whatever. They are 6x4 cargo body trucks. They look kind of like Urals, but not. A bit more boxy. So they're bringing out the 257B and the 255B variants. The 257 looks like it has train wheels. Yeah, looks like train wheels, but it's a very Soviet-looking truck. I have to that's the only way to describe it as Soviet.
Yeah, Waz posted these the other day.
Yeah, that's right. He was very excited about these.
Oh yeah.
Up next from Lucograph, these are 3D printed resin kits. They are bringing out Hansa Brandenburg C1s, the 129-229 series and the 169 series in 32nd scale. These are two very odd looking twin seat biplanes from the First World War. Wouldn't mind having one myself, although trying to do that lozenge pattern on that would be a pain in the nuts, but totally worth it.
It'd be fun.
Black Cat Models bringing out two landing ship, or LSM, the mediums, in two versions, the 40mm version and the 20mm version, both in 350 scale. So these two versions, basically it means that the 40mm version has a twin Bofors on it, and the 20mm version has two single Orlikans on it. That's about it.
Bofors. I got a funny story about Bofors.
Okay, shoot. Go for it.
Okay. So, we were on ship, right? We were doing some training in the well deck. And this fucking... It was evening time, and this fucking chief came up, this naval chief, who was like, hey, we need you guys to participate in cleaning the well deck. Or they do what's called FOD walk down, which is like a walkthrough to pick up any debris. And it's the Navy's job. It's not the Marine's job. And we were like, our corporal at the time was like, no, we're training. And the chief's like, who's your gunny? And without skipping a beat, my fucking corporal said, Gunny Bofa. And the chief was like, how you spell? So he spelled it out. Thought he was so serious. And the chief walked away. He's like, I go talk to your gunny. And the bro, corporal fucking, I ain't gonna say his name. The corporal turned around and looked at us. Yeah, yeah, gunny both of these nuts in your mouth, bitch. Anyways, let's keep going, guys. The funniest shit, bro. I swear, the chief thought he was so serious. Yeah, gunny bofa.
Oh, fuck.
God.
I want it.
Okay.
Oh, fuck. Yes, I want this.
Up next from Gecko Models, they're bringing out another version of their US M76 amphibious cargo carrier, the Otter. This is a late production. And it's, I think this is the enclosed version. It's got a 50 on the top and the guy looking very uncomfortable. Mm. That does not look comfortable at all and very exposed.
Very.
Yeah.
However,
well, it is the Marine Corps, so.
Yeah. However, these things have been very popular, and I would love to get my hands on one of these because they're just, I never even knew about this vehicle. We might have to do an episode on them or something.
Bro,
you know,
yeah. Or this like is like
amphib stuff.
This is literally like HIDF, bro, like River Patrol.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's so Marines. It's like, you know, use your body to protect the equipment.
Pretty much.
You are the reactive armor. You react to it.
Right. React to contact, bitch. Let that 50 scream.
Up next from Clear Prop, they're bringing out a Gloster E28-39 Pioneer in 48 scale. The Pioneer was Britain's very first jet aircraft that attained flight. The actual aircraft itself is currently sitting in the Science Museum in London. If you go up to the Aviation Hall, that the Pioneer is hanging from the ceiling. It is very, very cool. So I honestly, if I could get this kit, I would totally build it just because it's such a cool looking aircraft. And it's got a little bit of, you know, heritage behind it because Britain's first flying jet.
Now, you say flying jet. Did they have some that crashed into the ground immediately then?
Well, maybe not so much crash as never took off.
Oh, okay.
I mean, funnily enough, the idea or like the theoretical idea of jet engines was actually around before the Second World War.
Oh, yeah.
Like as early as the 20s, they had thought up of the actual concept itself. And like, if you like, the Italians sort of made one in the 30s, but it doesn't technically, it isn't technically a jet aircraft.
But, guy, the first jet aircraft was the 262.
Hmm.
No, it wasn't actually. Heinkel
made it. No, it actually was. Yep.
Pardon?
Yeah, I was about to say it was actually Heinkel, but yeah.
Yeah, with the,
And I've built one before. The little single seat thing. It's got a BMW Juno engine attached to the top of it.
No, guys. All the wearaboos say the first jet aircraft was a 262.
Nope. I know. Hang on. Germany first jet aircraft, not fighter. It was not the 262.
Oh, 100%. It was
something earlier made by Heinkel.
Was it the 152? Just a second.
Nah, it wasn't that. That wasn't the first one. There was one that was a concept prototype by the Germans that did achieve flight before the 262, but I can't remember what the hell it was called.
It was like the 162, though.
It was kind of like the 162, but it was an internal engine.
Yeah. You just strapped a fucking jet engine is pretty much what it was.
Not quite, no, it was fully built, inline built.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It was pretty much just a jet engine with a fucking cockpit on top of it.
Yeah, yeah, but I can't... I can picture the design in my head, but I can't fucking... You keep looking for it, I'll keep going through the news. If you can find it, let me know. It's driving me nuts. I know exactly what it looks like.
I know what you're talking about, too.
Whilst he taps away, although he might want to look away at his screen to look at this screen for this one.
Yes. Glenn,
MiniArt are bringing out another SDK FZ231, this time with the MG151 drilling turret. It's basically a Puma, but you take the drilling turret from the 251, chuck it in on top there, and you have one hell of an anti-infantry weapon.
Oh, God.
I just picked up the MiniArt Puma at the last model show.
Oh, nice. Should have got this one.
No, this one wasn't out. And don't worry, I'll get it.
Oh, I know you will, buddy. I know. One thing I do love about this box art, though, is the fact that there are so many parts that have that are clearly been taken off different vehicles. Like the drilling, you got this red primer camouflage. Then you got just panels from different vehicles that's had different schemes on it.
Yeah,
I love the look of that.
Clint, you got to do it like that, buddy.
Unfortunately, it is a what ifs. It is part of their what-if series, so it wasn't a real vehicle, but that just gives you more sort of permission to do whatever the hell you want with it, because no one can tell you otherwise.
Oh, yeah.
Third Battle of France. You go
crazy with 45, 46 series stuff.
Hell yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not finding anything. It's like, everything's like the first operational.
Yeah, but it's not operational. It's not, yeah, it's fucking...
Or, sorry, it said the first... let's see, what is it? World's first operational jet fighter. It's like, I don't want the first operational jet fighter. I just want the first operational jet aircraft.
It was a turbojet aircraft installed in Heinkel design aircraft. The Germans began the jet age on
the Heinkel HE-178. It flew on August
27th, 1939. HE-178. Yes, that one. Finally. God, that was annoying the fuck out of me. But that, yeah, so that was the first real, like, proper jet. Not the Italian Caproni or whatever the hell it was called. Weird looking thing, but it didn't fit. It wasn't technically a jet, even though it looked
like. And honestly, it looks more like a MiG. I mean, it's basically, like I said, a jet engine with a cockpit set on top of it.
Yeah. I really want one as a model, though. All those prototype jets, I really want them.
I'm pretty sure there's a kit out there.
I know, I think there is, but I can't remember who made it.
Right. Special Hobby makes one in 148.
Of course they do.
And it can be yours for $25.50 on eBay. And apparently Airfix makes one, too.
Oh, that's tempting.
Oh, no, sorry, never mind. That's just something else that's Airfix. It come up when I typed it in.
All right. Okay, from KP Model, as part of their high-tech limited edition series, they are bringing out the British fighter prototype, the Martin Baker MB5, British prototype 1944. This is sort of a bastardized... It's got nothing to do with the Mustang at all, even though it looks kind of like it.
Looks like they stretched out a Mustang and put a dual prop on it.
Yeah, basically. Apparently, as well, again, it did perform quite well, but just wasn't suitable for the needs at the time. It was kind of like, well, we've already got better things, so we don't really need it. It was more of a concept, I guess. But
bad concept there.
Yeah. However, the only other kit of the MB5 that I don't know of is a Vacuform kit, so... I would happily take this. I would happily have this. I mean, it does look kind of cool.
I mean, it looks cool.
It looks like the inbred family of the Mustang. Okay. It's cool.
Of what?
Of the Mustang.
Yeah, basically. Up next from Gecko Models in 35th scale, they are bringing out a British FV18001 Mark 1 80-inch 4x4 utility vehicle with canvas rooftop, early production. They're bringing out it's a Land Rover.
I was gonna say that looks like a Land Rover.
Yeah, I wanted to go through the entire fucking stupid name it's got, and it's like it's a Landy. It's a Land Rover, and I have a feeling it's a Series 1 Land Rover. Unfortunately, this kit does not include any crew figures. I don't know why Gecko decided to just omit crew figures, but it has a fully detailed driving and engine compartment. And, Series 1 Land Rover. I know Don was very excited about this.
Of course he is.
I mean, I would love to have it as well. I also really like the fact it's got the Gurkha sign on the front, so I would love it.
Now, do you think it says Land Rover on the kit anywhere? Or?
Well, I mean, it should on the badge on the front.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at a Dragon's kits, it's like on the road reels on German vehicles, instead of saying Continental, the last L is actually a U.
So
to get past copyright infringement, so all you have to do is like take a blade and scrape part of the U to make it into an L.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I did not know that.
Yep.
So I wonder. Yeah, I wonder if they have actual like Land Rover on the badge there.
Looks like Gecko Models is about to get sued.
Yeah. You know what I'd really like to do with this? You get the Safari zebra stripe ones?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I want to make. A Safari zebra stripe.
Make it just like some sort of backwoods bush thing that's been beat to hell.
Oh, hell yeah, like a South Africa or Botswana old Safari vehicle.
That yes.
What the fuck?
Okay, from KP again, in the High Tech Limited Edition series, we have the US experimental plane, the X-3 Stiletto prototype. This is during the time in the 50s and 60s where the US were constantly trying to break the sound barrier and do all sorts of weird things with jets, and the Stiletto was one of them. It's very long, very pointy. Can you call it an aircraft or just a man-guided rocket?
Yes.
Man-guided missile. That's basically all it is. I think it had landing gear, but I don't know.
I want to say the National Museum of the United States Air Force has one of these on display.
Probably. I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest.
Well, when we meet up in 2026,
we'll go have a look.
We'll go, yeah.
2025, isn't it?
Indiana show is 26.
I thought you were talking about Roscoe Turner next year.
Oh, no.
Never
mind. When we all meet up.
Oh, true.
Yeah. Either way, though, I would really love to have a model of that.
Yeah, that would be fun. It's Airfix.
Yeah, from Airfix, as part of their Airfix Club Limited Edition, you know, when they take an existing kit and basically rebox it in a fancy box and give it a couple of bloody new decals. this one is of the Messerschmitt ME410A3. I don't know why they keep going on about this aircraft. I mean, it's not an interesting aircraft. They seem to be treating it as their premier one. I don't know why. But they're bringing that out with two new limited edition, only if you're in the club, decals. You have the that is in Perugia in Italy, 1943. I am not going to pronounce the entire bloody designation because German.
Like that.
And they also have one that it was a captured version for the fighter interception unit RAF Witterington, Wittering, Great Britain, August 1944. So it is basically just a 410 in RAF captured marking. So you have the green and brown on top, the giant P in the middle, although the P is supposed to represent prototype. Don't know why they have it on a captured. You'd think it would have like C or something. And also possibly the worst thing in the world, a fully yellow underside, which
that'll help you blend in.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't really to blend in, it was more so, you know, AA didn't accidentally shoot you down, even though they really like to. That's why they got rid of the black and that's why they got rid of the black and white on Mark 1 Spitfires and Hurricanes.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. They got rid of it because they're like, oh, well, you know, it'd be good so, you know, our AA gun crews can recognize them and won't shoot them down. Yeah, it didn't matter. They weren't trained enough. They didn't. They were too trigger happy. They just shot at anything. So they eventually the RAF just went, fuck it. They're shooting at us anyway. Sky blue. Let's try and blend in instead.
Let's hide from the fuckers.
Pretty much. Kind of like, well, this didn't work. Screw it. Back to normal. And that's it for the model news. Up next, we have what we have been working on for the last few weeks. And up first is Garrison.
All right, so I got a couple slides here. I'm working on a Blaze Gap diorama showcasing the, I believe it's going to be the 12th SS, because they had a brief encounter with British troops. I've got two British paras that you'll see later. This is the Stu Commander. I was doing really well in the camo until I got to the fucking white color-ish, which is way too bright. And I made those dots way too big. Thanks, Carpal Tunnel. But, yeah, I'm going to do... He's not finished. I'm going to do an oil wash to hopefully tone that down. But, yeah, there's the example I went off on the left. So, yeah. Hopefully when he's hiding in the bushes of the Stug... It...
Didn't hear, like, the last part of that.
Yeah, your mic's going dead or something.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I was
you're
just
like,
saying.
You're like going off in the distance.
Oh, no, I can't. I was just saying that hopefully once, you know, he's all weathered up and with an oil wash, you won't really be able to notice him too much, the imperfections when he's sitting in the Stug with all the bushes around him. Here's the diorama itself. On the left, you got the rough layouts without the figures, and on the right, you have the layout with the figures. It'd be something like that. The German infantry running from behind the Stug. So the Stug can back up, because, you know, the Krauts got their asses handed to him at the Flays Gap. So, and then on the very top center, you can see two British paras loading up a Piat to engage the Stug.
I mean, that is kind of like the max range you could have of a Piat.
Well, I mean, the story is the Stug's backing down the road, so they're going to wait, like, you know, a little bit to engage, but where they can still hit the top of it. Yeah, I would not use a Piat that close.
I mean, it's a spring-loaded spigot mortar you have to carry around. Yeah, no. Huh? I mean, at that range, you're kind of better off just arming it and throwing it down. You'll probably get more range. More accuracy.
Probably.
More effectiveness.
Right? Either way, them are two soon-to-be-dead British paratroopers.
Yeah.
Probably. Maybe. I don't know. Time will tell. Actually, it won't. But, yeah. Let your imagination run wild, gents. And here's the Stug before the episode started and before I started painting the figure. It's all bushed up. It's got the pin wash on it, and it's very glossy because I put a gloss coat on it so the pin wash would run better. But yeah, that's the Stug, and right now I have it currently weathered, letting it dry. So.
Very nice.
Very nice.
Thank you, thank you.
And I'm also building a Stug. This is TACOMS. Yeah. I've got the lower hull put together, the swing arms. Done some soldering and on the photo etch pieces. And I got the casemate put on as of last night. So it's getting closer.
Good lad. And what scheme are you doing this as again?
It's going to be a winter whitewash, 5th SS.
Das ist gut, das ist gut.
Alright, on to mine. So, this is a bust that I printed off at the printer and spent a couple nights painting up, just as purely practice for flesh tones and, you know, busts and all that. It's only the second time I've done something like this, so I figured, well, I'm kind of stalled on a couple of builds, but I wanted to actually do something, so I was like, oh, I'll give this a lash, see how it goes. And I don't think it's too bad for my second time doing it.
Not bad at all.
Das ist gut, das ist gut.
And here we've got the progress on the Condor. She's finally sitting on landing gear, although, like, I have reinforced the hell out of that landing gear, made sure it's all thing. It still looks like it's going to collapse at any moment, and it's just the nature of the design. Like, you can see why they used to collapse all the time. You know,
right?
It's this very complex, weird landing gear that sticks out. You know, the wheels stick out from the bloody struts and all of that. So it's not like the weight's not going onto the top of the wheels, you know, over the top. The weight is actually going in from the side, so it's more, it's just very complex.
It's a very crappy design.
it so was. And also the fact that you're coupled with a very high tail wheel, you can see why either the landing gear collapsed or it just snapped in half. Very weak. So this one I had a few issues with the wash. It kind of, you can kind of see a tired line, but yeah, I just went with the heavy weathered look, hence why I've just done a whole bunch of chipping all around to the engines and stuff like that, and we just went, fuck it, I'll lean into it. But it's looking pretty good right now. I'm kind of quite happy with it.
Very nice. Very, very nice.
Indeed, good sir, indeed.
And lastly, my 1 to 700 crane for my Japanese harbor diorama. So it's gone slightly further along since these photos. I have actually changed out the wires on the top for straight sprues, so they have a bit more, what's the word I'm looking for? Straightness, rigidity? I guess.
Okay.
Not so much. It's more uniform curve as opposed to this one where it's a bit bumpy and difficult, and I had difficulty, you know, getting it to actually do a sort of sag how I wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's had a wash done on it as well, so it's looking a bit darker than this. But so all of these wires and the wire bracing just on the top there is all scratch built, so it's not part of the kit. So I was just using someone else's build as a reference to see just where the wires go, because then because that's the little bit on the top there that has all the wires going to it. That's the actual where the wires drop down, so you can pick stuff up. So I'll have a Jake float plane suspended underneath it.
Cool.
In mid-air. Very nice. So yeah, so that's going along well. I'm up to the point where having to paint little fiddly things, and that's the part where I get discouraged the most because it's just boring. So just need to find some time and just power through it.
I feel like that's like half of modeling sometimes, is something you don't want to do to get to something you want to do.
Yeah, yep. It's just that, oh, I hate this part. I'm just going to have to just set some time and just do it.
Power through it.
Yep. All right, book, movie, documentary, and YouTube recommendations. First off.
We will not go to Tropsy, which is, this gentleman was a Belgian volunteer. 17 years old, he was a motorcycle dispatch rider. He actually spent most of the war, though, injured, being shot, and then went back to the Eastern Front, got shot again. And that's Jesus. pretty much what saved him, was being in hospital. But very good book. Gives a good picture of what life was like behind the front lines, and just like the shitty roads and the supply situation.
I mean, that's a part that you don't really hear much about, is the you know, that sort of rear echelon. Was he rear, or
yeah, he was a dispatch rider.
Yeah, so, but that's a part that you don't really hear much about, just those little small parts of the war that sort of made up an important part.
Mm-hmm. So he spent a lot of his time going between the front and the, you know, behind the lines.
Ugh, that must have been fun.
Yeah.
Okay, and I have two book recommendations. First one is Cinderella Boys by Leo McKinstry. A very easy read. I read this entire book in about 4 hours.
Oh, shit.
Well, I was on a train from Canberra to Sydney, so I had a lot of time. It was about a four-hour train ride, so I read the whole thing in the train ride. And it is very interesting. You know, they're talking about the coastal... It's about the Coastal Command, the forgotten RAF force. So they were involved at the Battle of Atlantic, and basically their whole story is somewhat similar to the US Marines, actually. They got whatever they could get, and they they didn't get the good, you know, the good stuff. They're kind of just like, we'll take it. We'll take anything. So they talk. So it went along about how they started with the Vickers Wildebeest biplanes, and they used to send out tiger moths. No guns, no bombs, no nothing. They just sent tiger moths out just as a fake patrol, just to get U-boats to actually dive. You know. So they started out with that, and then their progression going to get bow forts and their issues with them and bow fighters, and suddenly the bow fighter was like the best weapon they had at anti-shipping. You know, talking about getting liberators and trying to get that kind of stuff, how the liberators worked, the technological advancements, to the point where U-boats had to spend most of their time submerged. Because even at night, they weren't safe. You know, early in the war, they spent most of their time above water at night because they couldn't be seen. They could dive quickly and all of that. And then the Coastal Command invented the Lee light, and suddenly they had nowhere to hide except underwater. So, talking about all the infighting, it was quite interesting. The infighting between all like Coastal Command and Arat and Bomber Command and all of that kind of stuff, just for trying to get supplies. And that kind of stuff. So, and even talking about how they attacked U-boats, you know, using rockets, using bombs, depth charges, and stuff like that. So it was really interesting. It's a really good book. And the second one was from Patrick Lindsay, The Coast Watchers. The Coast Watchers were in the Pacific. You had all these plantation workers, people who lived Rabaul and stuff like that. A whole lot of they were all civilians, and the way that they were formed is they all had long range radios, because you had all these small islands all connected to each other, and the only way they could talk was via long range radio. So they were all somewhat experts in it. They knew how to use them and stuff like that. And then the Japanese invaded Rabaul and stuff like that. And a lot of Australians and New Zealanders and stuff, they stayed behind. And these plantation workers hid in the jungle, and they had these long-range radios they could pack up and move with a whole bunch of natives. And basically, they just had overwatch over everything the Japanese did. And they would report on long-range radios back to Port Moresby and stuff like that. And, you know, so no Japanese ship left port without being reported on, no aircraft, no bomb. The amount of, they gave an extra hour and a half notice for fighters to intercept bombers, sort of thing.
No
they did
shit.
This. They were constantly being hunted by the Japanese. The Japanese knew they were there. They knew they were in the jungle somewhere. They just couldn't find them. So they were sitting there looking out of the jungle, sitting there going, I know there's a team of coast watchers out there. They can't do anything about them. They couldn't find them. They were constantly on the move. It was a horrendously dangerous job. And this goes through their entire progression through the war of basically going from just one-man bands and small parties reporting to they got up to the point where they got permission to start doing guerrilla warfare and, you know, the natives... Natives getting armed with Browning automatic shotguns and M1 carbines, and suddenly hunting Japanese down and stuff like that. So it was a really, really good book. So, and it's part of that this whole Pacific, you know, lesser known Pacific theater that I've been looking into. So, and this one, it was a really, really good insight into it. You know, they were talking about, you know, there were a whole bunch of missionaries that stayed behind with their convents and all of that, and the Japanese mostly left them alone, but didn't always. And you know, the whole sort of behind the lines dynamic and Japanese occupation with the natives and stuff like that. It was, it's worth going into. It's worth having a read.
There was a story I read about one of these guys. I believe it was on New Guinea when the Marines landed. It's like he had seen him. It's like, how are we going to make contact with him? So it's like they took his 303 Enfield, attached a very tattered Union Jack to it, and then started walking down the beach with his native guides while singing a very bad rendition of U.S. national anthem.
That had to be such a sketchy moment, bro.
Oh yeah. And of course, the Coast Watchers were responsible for rescuing John F. Kennedy when PT Boat 109 was split in half by a Japanese destroyer. And also, the Coast Watchers are credited for the success of Guadalcanal, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, they said they... I think the Americans even said that Guadalcanal succeeded because of the Coast Watchers.
Yeah, they was given the Cactus Air Force enough time to get in the air and meet them.
Yeah. And then and then even with landings and stuff like that and where the Japanese were and all of that, it was really cool. They did a significant contribution to the war, but then just not that known about. Or not that well recognized, at least.
Exactly.
We need a lot more Pacific shit, stuff like that.
Yeah.
What all the countries did in the Pacific. Like, don't get me wrong, I know the Marine Corps did a lot, the U.S. Army did a lot too, but they're, Australia, New Zealand, the Philippines.
Not the Free French, fuck them.
Yeah, the Free French did fuck all. yeah. But those are my two recommendations.
Very nice.
Okay, our model store of the week, Hobbytown USA. I believe you two can speak on this as to why.
Yes. So, I've got a Hobbytown USA in my town, Wichita, Kansas, just off of Kellogg, and I believe it's Rock Road, on the southeast side, a shopping mall center. It's a local hobby store. They got a little expensive, but most hobby stores got to be to supplement for online shopping.
I think Garrison's walked away from his microphone again.
Yeah.
Hello.
So I got one in Castleton, Indiana. It's used to be really good, and then they moved, and it was still very good. And then they got pretty much told, it's like, hey, we're not going to renew your lease. You guys got to get the fuck out. And so they moved a second time. And since then, it's like they hardly carry any model kits. So,
damn.
Yeah. Yeah, I hardly go to them anymore.
All right. So, Hobbytown USA, model store of the week.
All right. So, we currently have a group build going on. This is our World War One group build. It's going on until February 1st, so you guys still get a little bit of time. If you want to join or if you're working on something, we would love to have as many entries as possible. We have recreational and competition. And this is the last group build where we do a really dope award system. The next award system will be a little different, but if you want your chances at a really cool award, go ahead, join our Discord, see what the award is, and make something.
And of course, if you are not in the Discord, you prefer Instagram, you can follow us on MMP Group Builds. That's MMP_group_build. You will find a way to follow, keep track of people's progress, although I need to update that Instagram page. And that's a page where you will find any other future group builds as well. Just a reminder, you can also join us on Facebook under the Micro Machines podcast as well, if you are more into Facebook type stuff as well. And we have come to the end of our episode. So as usual, at the end of an episode, we'd like to thank our Patreon supporters. We have our Pinju supporters, Paul Gallagher, Lord Floki, Robert Judson, Burrell Mastroni, and Liam Barnett. And our Pinjuice follower is Robert Brisbane. You guys help us keep the lights on and help support with some of the costs around here. So we thank you enormously.
Yes, thank you guys.
Thank you guys very much.
And with that, we have hit the end of another episode. I believe this was episode 74 now. Boy, we are getting up in numbers, aren't we?
We sure are.
Hell yeah, we're heading to that 100, man. Episode 100.
That's going to be a special episode.
Yeah, and I reckon that will probably be next year, to be honest, is when we'll get it.
Yep.
So,
and for that episode, Garrison's going to walk us through all the war crimes he's committed. So
I've never been to war.
Oh, yes.
And that stopped you?
That's right.
Is it still a war crime if you're not in war but you're part of the military?
I don't know.
He doesn't want to answer.
I plead the fifth. Anyway, so without further ado, a bit of a shorter episode this week, but we have a very, very interesting and very good episode coming up next week. So until then, you have been watching and listening to the Micro Machines Podcast. We thank you for supporting and watching and viewing our content from the bottom of our hearts. And we'll just like to say, we will see you in the next episode. Bye for now.
Deuces.
Hey, yeah.